It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, science just figured out what happens in the brain when we hear music and, most importantly, where it happens.
First, the American political and legal landscapes were shaken by the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia at a Texas resort over the weekend.
Scalia was first appointed to the bench by Ronald Reagan and was praised by conservatives during his tenure. His death took place during a critical time when President Obama is in his final year in office and both Republicans and Democrats are vying for control of the Senate and the White House.
Ryan Owens joins us now. He is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and an honorary fellow at the Institute for Legal Studies. Ryan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, Scalia's death was a huge shock over the weekend. How important will that death and the search for his successor be in the political and judicial circles over the next months?
Well, it's going to be huge. I think it's, you know, this vacancy and the process that the Senate and the president used to fill it or to not fill it is really just going to monopolize the media's attention, I think.
So it seems as though the battle lines are being drawn. The president has said it's his constitutional duty to nominate a successor, to try to get that successor confirmed. And on the other hand, you have Republican leadership saying here's a president at the tail end of his presidency and that they think that this should be the job of the next president. How is that battle going to unfold?
Well, it is tough to say. I mean, on the one hand, I'm a bit surprised that Senator McConnell came out as quickly as he did to say that they wouldn't move on this nomination. I suspect pretty strongly that the president will nominate someone in short order, and then it'll be a question of whether or not McConnell and Senate Republicans want to sort of dig in their heels and not act on this nomination, or if they actually want to sort of stretch it out a little bit. I wouldn't be surprised if they actually go ahead and move forward with the nomination process, but ultimately reject whoever the president submits.
How long does it typically take to select and try to confirm a Supreme Court justice?
Well, it's a good question, and it's one that depends on the context. So, not surprisingly, when you've got unified government, so when the president and the Senate majority are of the same party, things move much quicker. When you've got divided government, things kind of take a little bit longer. In particular, if you look at a nomination such as this, which we typically call a critical nomination, that is a nomination that can move the median member of the court, right? So we're going to have a swing vote right now that would go from potentially from Anthony Kennedy over to Stephen Breyer. Those kinds of nominations tend to take longer, and they are substantially less likely to succeed.
So looking at how much time President Obama has left in the White House, do you look at that from where you're sitting and say he's got enough time to get this done? Or do you look at that and say, you know, there is the case to be made that this is not enough time to give this its due process?
Well, there are two questions here. I think in answer to just sort of the nuts and bolts, is there enough time? I suspect the answer to that is yes. But the follow-up question is more along the lines of political time. You know, is there enough political time here with which to work? And that's less clear. I mean, I think, you know, the arguments on both sides are there. They're both reasonable. You know, it is true that the president has the constitutional authority to nominate someone. It's also true that the Senate has the advice and consent power. I suppose, you know, if you believe to some degree that having some kind of majoritarian input, that is public opinion, having an input on, the selection of nominees, I think, you know, waiting 9 months has some appeal to it. There are reasonable arguments on both sides on this one.
Well, let's play this out a little if we can. If there is no new appointee to the Supreme Court, what happens to the rulings that have already possibly been voted on when Scalia was alive and also to the cases that have already been decided on by appellate courts?
Right. So basically what happens when a justice passes away and his or her votes have not yet been publicly, you know, recorded, released in an opinion, those votes are then nullified. So essentially what you have would be, for example, say a 5-4 decision in a case, dealing with the labor unions. Scalia's vote, assuming it was in the 5-4 majority, would be eviscerated. We have a 4-4 split then. The first thing the court would do would be to find out if any of the existing justices want to change their votes. Assuming they do not, then the case just winds up getting affirmed by an equally divided court. So the lower court's opinion will be affirmed by an equally divided court. But importantly, the Supreme Court, by doing that, would not be establishing any precedent.
We're talking with Ryan Owens right now, professor of political science at UW-Madison and honorary fellow at the Institute for Legal Studies. And we're talking about the upcoming battle to replace Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Washington Post over the weekend had an article pointing out that two-thirds of appellate courts are liberal. So what would that mean for Republicans and their wish to let this appointee be something that's taken on by the next president?
Well, you know, I've heard a lot about that. I'm not sure just how relevant that is, honestly. You know, when you affirm the lower court's decision, that's fine. That means a lot of these lower court decisions will be affirmed. But on the other hand, the court will not be establishing any precedent. So, you know, I'm not sure that matters all that much. In terms of the broader spectrum of the court, you know, being able to audit or supervise these lower courts, well, I think, you know, if you're a Republican, you really want to see the Supreme Court continue to be 5-4 with a conservative majority to really supervise what the lower courts are doing. And without that, it certainly makes it more difficult.
Now, Republicans in the Senate, like Ted Cruz, have already said that they might filibuster any justice nominated under the current presidency. How likely is it that an Obama-appointed justice would be confirmed given that filibuster risk?
Yeah, so, you know, that's a really complicated dynamic to this. It seems to me that maybe the best political strategy for Republicans right now would be, rather than say we're just not going to deal with this at all, to actually move forward with the nomination and, you know, ultimately, of course, reject that nominee. I'm sure they could find some grounds on which to do it. Just, you know, the Democrats found grounds on which to reject Bork and others. But stretch it out so that you get towards the end of the summer, and after that rejection, then you make the argument about we don't have enough time to move forward on this. Now, that said, you know, what they could do is they could use Ted Cruz's suggestion of a filibuster to their advantage. If they do think they're going to suffer some political loss here by holding up the nominee, excuse me, they could say they want to move forward on it, but they can't because of Ted Cruz. So it's possible that they could use his statements and use them, you know, to their benefit.
Now, if Republicans are able to block any Obama-appointed justices, that seems like it might add up to something like a almost year-long vacancy, possibly longer. Have we seen anything like that before, and what might those ramifications be?
Sure. Well, we have seen lengthy vacancies before. Now, the dynamics were different, but, for example, Justice Blackmun, there were 391 days between the time Abe Fortas left the Supreme Court and Justice Blackmun filled that position. Now, of course, there were a couple of failed nominations in between then. So Nixon had two nominees get rejected by the Senate. Harry Blackmun was his number three. So those dynamics are a little bit different, but the vacancy was 391 days long. There are a couple of others that were over 200 days. So the problem, I think, is, you know, the court can devise ways around dealing with this. So they can take all 4-4 cases and hold them over for the next court term. There are things they can do to deal with this, but it absolutely is not something that justices want to deal with. They don't like 4-4 ties. They'll do whatever they can, for example, to get out of having to recuse themselves just so that they can avoid the probability of a 4-4 split. You know, there are ways that they can deal with this, but I suspect that they are not happy with what's going on here.
I'm sure the White House is already going over a list of names, and one of the names that we keep hearing so far is Sri Srinivasan. Mm-hmm. What do we know about who that person is and what other names might be joining that on a list?
Well, he has a good pedigree. He's got, you know, recently appointed to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a very prestigious circuit court. He clerked for a conservative Fourth Circuit judge, J. Harvey Wilkinson. He also clerked for former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. You know, he comes off as particularly moderate, and so that might appeal to some people. I suspect, however, that that's not going to be satisfactory to most of the Republicans in the Senate. You know, my hunch, if I had to predict on this, I would think that the president might want to use a rejected nominee for political hay. So I think one of the things Obama is likely to want to do is to try to motivate African Americans to come out and vote in this next election. Democrats need them if they're going to win. So I wouldn't be surprised if the president nominated an African American, potentially a female African American, to try to motivate women to come out and vote as well. So I think, you know, they're probably looking down the road here, thinking even if we do get somebody nominated, potentially reviewed, it's unlikely that, you know, they'll get accepted. So let's see if we can make some political hay out of this.
And Ryan, just very briefly as we wrap up here, what is this going to do to the presidential race?
Well, we're certainly going to hear a lot more about the court. that's pretty clear. One thing we know from looking at the literature on some of the economics literature, behavioral economics literature, is that people value loss more than they do gain, which is to say they're more motivated by their fear of loss than they are their expectation of gain. And so I think Republicans, conservatives having a 5-4 majority or previously having a 5-4 majority are going to feel that sting a little bit more. So I suspect, if anything, this might motivate them a little bit more than it does the Democrats. But I'll tell you, the Supreme Court is so important in this upcoming cycle that, you know, both sides are going to be particularly motivated.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us.
You bet.
That was Ryan Owens, professor of political science at UW-Madison and honorary fellow at the Institute for Legal Studies. He joined us to talk about the upcoming battle to replace Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. For years, scientists have reasoned music is popular, it's ancient, and continually ranked as one of the most supreme pleasures of life. Given all that, they wondered, is there a region of the brain that responds specifically to music?
There's a region of the brain that deals specifically with visual cues, like reading people's faces. For a long time, scientists couldn't find that similar area of the brain that responded to music. Until now, a research team at MIT has been given a peek into what's being called the brain's music room. Using functional MRIs, they've identified the specific neural pathways that react almost exclusively to music.
Here to talk about the findings are two members of that team from MIT. Nancy Kanwisher is a professor at MIT and an investigator at the McGovern Institute for Brain Research. Her lab uses functional MRIs to investigate the functional architecture of the human brain. Nancy, great to have you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And also with us today, we've got Sam Norman Hagner, a postdoctoral researcher at MIT, whose work focuses on understanding the human auditory cortex. Sam, welcome.
Thanks.
And so, Nancy, going into this research, what exactly were you looking for?
Well, as background, I've been looking for the last 20 years or so at the overall organization of the human brain. So we think that's a really exciting question because it's basically a way to ask, who are we? What are our brains made up of? What are the basic components of the human mind? And that's been a very exciting research program, and we've discovered a lot of specialized regions of the brain that respond very selectively to when you do very specific kinds of things, like face recognition, or reading a word, or thinking about what another person is thinking, or understanding a sentence. Each of those activates a very specific part of the brain. And so we wanted to know for a long time whether music might be another mental function that has its own special purpose brain machinery. So that was a tough question to answer until Sam came along. So maybe he can tell you what he's done.
Right. And Sam, why did music seem like such a likely candidate for dedicated brain architecture, so to speak?
Well, one of the nice things about the approach that we used to reveal this putatively music-selective region is that the analysis that we used to find it basically didn't know anything about what it should find, didn't know whether it should find something that was selected for music or speech or, you know, whatever else. And so as a result, when we ran this analysis and it basically revealed this neural population that responded selectively to music, we found that sort of particularly striking because basically the analysis didn't know anything about what it should find a priori.
So you said this is a kind of a neutral way. This is computational. How did this work? How did you get to this answer, Nancy?
The simple way of thinking of it is you start with a large amount of data. So we have 10,000 individual three-dimensional pixels or voxels across 10 subjects' brains in their broader auditory cortex, and we know the magnitude of the response of each of those pixels to each of 165 different sounds. So that's 18 million numbers. And then what we do is we ask the math to simplify this and give us a simple description of the data, and it basically finds six simple components that can account for most of the data. And that didn't have to be. That was a cool result in itself, that we could understand and characterize the response of the brain to this wide array of different kinds of sounds with six simple patterns. And it just emerged when we looked at those six patterns that one of them reflected selectivity for music. And that's just remarkable because the space of possible things we could find is just enormous. And the fact that one of them very neatly mapped on, just when we looked at it, you could just see, oh, that's music selectivity, a high response to all of these wildly different kinds of music sounds, and a low response to everything else. So it just popped right out of the raw data.
And I want to give a listen to some of the things that your subjects were listening to, because you have a whole array of, I guess, auditory cues, different sounds, and music. Let's listen to the sounds first.
It's supposed to either rain or snow.
Hannah is good at compromising.
Okay, so you've got the stuff of everyday life there. You've got toilets flushing. You've got people talking. You've got people brushing your teeth. The brains of your subjects heard all that. And they also heard some music. They heard stuff like this. So they heard all that, tons of different styles of music there, all those different sounds mixed in. How did the brain tell them apart?
Well, so, I mean, like, one of the interesting aspects of the finding is that this music selective population that we discovered responded to lots of different types of music. And one of the sort of interesting facts about music in general is that music is a surprisingly or is a remarkably heterogeneous category. There are lots of different types of things that people typically call music, and that's very different from the types of categories that we know exist for other types of things. So, for example, speech is a much more homogeneous category. You know, the different types of speech sounds that people encounter are in some sense much more similar than the different types of music that we encounter. And so the fact that you find a brain region that responds in some sense strongly to all of these different types of music is sort of one of the interesting results of the experiment.
To back up a moment, music is fascinating because every human culture that's been studied has it, and no animal that's been studied has anything approaching human music. And so it's both uniquely and universally human, and yet at the same time, nobody even knows why we have it. So evolutionary theorists have been fighting for a long time trying to understand why we have music, and nobody has a really clear story about why we have it. And so one story was that music just kind of piggybacks on other brain mechanisms, for example, mechanisms for understanding speech or processing language or God knows what else, right? And what our result shows is understanding music or perceiving music isn't just a byproduct of other mechanisms. It has its own special purpose mechanism. So it's its own thing. It's not a byproduct. And I think that's a fascinating result of this research.
We're talking right now with Nancy Kanwisher and Sam Norman Hagner, part of the team that use functional MRIs to locate specific neural pathways in the brain that respond exclusively to music. And as you were saying, Nancy, from an evolutionary perspective, it doesn't seem like music would be as important to survival as, say, speech. So what do we know about why music may have this privileged role in the brain, and how is that going to change the way that we think about music?
Well, the why questions are very hard. I think the answer could easily have been otherwise, and it's an empirical result that, wow, apparently we do have this special purpose machinery. The question of why different mental functions get specialized machinery in the brain is a really big, important one, but we just don't know the answer. And I want to mention that, like, not everything that has special machinery in the brain is the product of evolution and natural selection. So, for example, there's a part of the brain that responds very selectively and strongly to visually presented words. And that can't be a result of natural selection because people haven't been reading long enough for evolution to have crafted it. So we shouldn't assume that just because there are special neural mechanisms for music that they've evolved. It may be that they result from extensive experience with music. And this is something we can't tell yet from our current experiments. But Sam has lots of ideas of what to do next to find out.
Right, and I'd love to hear that, Sam. Where would you like to see this research go from here?
Well, so there are a lot of sort of open questions about what this specific music population does. So, for example, you asked the question of, you know, how does your brain differentiate between all the different types of music that you typically listen to? And that's basically a question that we don't really know the answer to. We know that there's, you know, this population that responds strongly to lots of different types of music, but we don't know, for example, whether there are subpopulations within this area that, say, respond to musical rhythms or to musical pitches or to musical harmonies. Basically, we don't know how all of the different aspects of musical structure that you're sensitive to and care about are mapped in this population and other populations of the brain.
Does this tell you as a researcher, though, just for the layperson, that, yeah, there's a reason why we respond so powerfully to music?
That's a very hard question, I think to answer. I mean, it suggests that music is a sufficiently sort of important category to warrant, you know, a relatively large piece of tissue to process it. But exactly how that maps onto, you know, our appreciation of music and the emotional impact that music has on us is a sort of a harder question to answer, I think.
All right, we'll leave it there. Nancy and Sam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
That was Nancy Kanwisher and Sam Norman Hagner. They're part of the team that use functional MRIs to locate specific neural pathways in the brain that respond especially to music. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. From the Islamic State to Russia, Iran to Saudi Arabia, the hotspots in international news often have something in common. They're home to a big part of the world's supply of oil. As remote as those regions may be from our local gas station, our next guest says there's a direct link between what we buy and what goes wrong in resource-rich parts of the world.
He says our moral beliefs have been corrupted by dependence on oil and other mineral resources, and American foreign policy has ignored and even supported tyrannical and oppressive governments around the world to keep that supply flowing.
Leif Wenaar joins us now. He's chair of philosophy and law at King's College London. His new book is Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. Leif, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. Great to be with you both.
A lot of your book focuses on oppression and tyranny in foreign countries, but your argument is really pitched closer to home, here in the Western world, I think, that consumes these products. So why should a consumer, say, here in Wisconsin, think about the impact of our oil consumption and other resources on the rest of the world?
Well, think about it. I mean, some of the people there might have read the article in the New York Times today that I wrote about, is the world getting better? And it generally is getting better, except in countries that produce a lot of oil. So look around right now. We got ISIS and Assad and Syria, refugee crisis, Libya, Iran, Saudi Arabia, all these countries giving us so much trouble. Where does the money for all that trouble come from? After all, those bombs and bullets and propaganda, it's all very expensive. Well, you know, ultimately, that money comes from us when we fill up at the gas station and pay for oil, and not only at the gas station, but for anything that's made with oil or transported with oil, which is just about everything we buy.
So we're morally implicated, in a sense, in oppression and tyranny that's on our dime, you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, there's not much we can do about it right now. Wherever we go, whatever we buy, we use energy, and a lot of that energy is right now from oil. But we can change the rules that run the world. If we try now, we can get ourselves out of business with those men of blood overseas and stop sending them all of that money.
We'll get into some of your recommendations on how to do that in a minute, but I want to talk about this idea of the resource curse, because you'd think, you know, our country found a valuable mineral, gold, diamonds, oil, whatever. Hooray, we're all rich. But that's this resource curse idea says, no, it doesn't really work out to everyone's benefit.
You're so right, and it's so ironic, because resources should be a blessing. But in so many places where the government is not accountable to the people of the country, resources are just a curse. And it's so interesting why that should be so. So natural resources like oil, you can think of them as just big reservoirs of cash underground. And the way the world works right now, well, whoever can control those reservoirs under the ground will get all the cash, and they can use that money in whatever way they want. So if it's an armed group like ISIS, they can use the money to buy more weapons. Or if it's an authoritarian government like Saudi Arabia, it can use the money for oppression and spreading its extreme version of Islam around the world.
Now, you point out that in some cases, I think you point toward Sweden as a country. They've got, oil from the North Sea. They've figured out how to share the proceeds with their general citizenry. Why is that the exception? Why is it the norm that a country with this rich resource has maybe a dictator at the top and a lot of people not participating in the benefit at the bottom.
Yeah, it's Norway over there, and it's
Norway.
Not only Norway, it's the United States. Think of our vast, vast natural resources. We've got everything in the United States, not only oil, but minerals aplenty, and in general, it does great for us. What's the difference between countries where oil is a blessing and countries where oil is a curse? It really is one thing. Did the oil money come in before the country became democratic? That is, did the oil money come in before the people had control of the government? If the oil money comes in when there's a strong man in power like Gaddafi in Libya, or if the oil comes in when there's an armed group in power like we see now amongst the armed groups in Libya, then the money just goes to pay for more authoritarianism and violence. That's when oil money is really trouble, and when it comes in non-democratic countries.
We're talking to Leif Wenner about his new book, Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. Let's talk about how the West, how say, the United States, relates to those countries with a lot of a resource like oil, but without that representative government, do we help create a more accountable government in those countries, or have we reinforced autocracy?
Well, you know what? We have tried every possible strategy towards oil-rich, non-democratic countries. And whatever strategy we take, it ends up working out really bad for those countries and for us. So let's just look back. I mean, over the last 40 years, all the countries that have been giving us trouble, starting with the Soviet Union, and then Iran and Iraq, and then Libya, and then the genocide in Darfur, and now Iraq and Syria and Libya again. What our strategies towards these countries have been quite varied. Sometimes we go for containment. Sometimes we do sanctions. Sometimes we do invasions. Sometimes we make an alliance with the authoritarian regime like we have with the Saudis. But whatever strategy we take politically, these countries always end up biting us back, because the violence that oil generates over there always ends up sloshing back onto us, whether we want to get involved or not.
So that seems pretty pessimistic anyway. If we've tried a lot of strategies, we're still where we are. Those countries are still despotisms in many cases. What's a better way to do things?
Well, Rob, you're going to be surprised to hear this, but I'm actually a very optimistic guy. So there is one very old, very bad rule that's causing this trouble, and we take it entirely for granted because it's been around for hundreds of years, but it actually makes no sense and we can change it. This is just the old bad rule that says we'll buy oil from whoever in a foreign country can control it by force. So, for example, when Saddam took over Iraq in a coup, we started buying Iraq's oil from him. And then when ISIS took over those same wells, the world started buying Iraq's oil from ISIS. Our rule basically says might makes right. Now, that rule makes no sense from an ordinary perspective, right? If there's a gas station in Madison and an armed gang takes it over, nobody thinks that the law should give the bystanders the right to buy the gas from that armed gang. But that is actually how the world works now. Might makes right. That's the rule that puts us into business with whoever can be the most violent and coercive and extreme overseas. And that's the rule that sends all of our dollars at the pump and at the checkout to these violent actors abroad.
But an argument for that, I guess, is a government of, say, the United States is first and foremost trying to see to the needs of its own citizens, American citizens. If, therefore, oil and other commodities are necessary for the functioning of our economy, we should pay whoever's selling it to buy it and let them worry about their own problems, I guess.
It could be. But look at all the problems that oil has given us. Like I say, our biggest threats and crisis over 40 years have come from these oil states, all the way back to the Soviet Union surging ahead of us in the nuclear arms race, and all this parade of horrors and threats that we keep getting. And I'm sorry to say that it looks like things are going to get worse in these countries. So the director of the CIA stood up last week and said, The Middle East is facing unprecedented violence and bloodshed. Things there look like they're really destabilizing all over the place. Right now, when this bad old rule of might makes right is in effect, we only have these awful, clumsy tools at hand to try to contain the violence and the extremism. We can invade. We can put sanctions on. We can fly drones over. But these are such clumsy tools trying to check the unchecked power of these actors over there who are empowered by our money. And let me just say, the violence in the Middle East, if it gets worse, is really going to get worse for us, too. Almost all of our recessions have been preceded by oil price spikes, and you can just see the extremism that's been generated in this region has started spreading farther and farther around the world, not only to Asia and to Europe, but maybe starting even here, too.
We're talking to Leif Wenaar about his new book. It's called Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the impact our consumption of oil and other resources has on the rest of the world? Should U.S. foreign policy work to keep those resources flowing, even if it means supporting oppression in other countries? And what questions do you have for our guest? You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with Leif Wenaar, philosopher and author of the new book, Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that we in the U.S. have a moral responsibility for damage created by the oil and other commodities we consume? Should we change our foreign policy, push for political change in other countries, even if it endangers our supply of oil and other key economic resources? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Leif, I wanted to get into some of your recommendations now. You say we should, as a matter of public policy, try to ban imports from authoritarian countries. Can you hash that out a little?
Sure. And let me just say that it's so important that we start thinking about this. Folks out there might so far be thinking, okay, we know that oil causes a lot of trouble. That's not new. But here's something that is new just in the last few years. And let me just say this very clearly. We don't need authoritarian oil anymore. We don't need to buy oil from those guys anymore. We have a lot of oil in the country now. Even as we transition away from fossil fuels, we should also be transitioning away from authoritarian oil. We can do it. We don't need that oil. And since it's President's Day, let me just mention that buying oil from authoritarian regimes violates one of America's own deepest principles, which was enunciated best by Abraham Lincoln, actually, in his first inaugural. And this is just the principle that a country belongs to its people. It's the people and not power in each country who should make the ultimate decision on what happens to the country, including its resources. So if we made our laws according to our own deepest American principles, we would say, from now on, we are going to taper off our purchases of oil from any country where the people could not possibly be holding their government accountable for their selling off the oil.
And on a related note, you say that we need to try to enforce people's rights to their resources. So in the example you gave, if that gang has taken over the gas station, helping to restore it to public control, taking the gang out of power. Now, that can mean a lot of different things, from, sanctions to polite nudges to military intervention. How would you see this working?
This is a totally peaceful change that we can do on our own country to promote democratic transitions abroad. Our soldiers can stay home this time. All we need to do is to align our own laws with our own ideas and say we're no longer believing that we have a right to buy oil from anyone who's selling it off without the people's possible assent. So we change our own laws for our own people on our own soil, and we say, for example, who rules in Saudi Arabia is none of our business, but right now, that regime will simply qualify for none of our business. We don't need their oil, and in fact, it violates our own principles to buy that oil from them.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Linda on the line in La Crosse. Linda, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, Linda.
I'd like to, I think for our moral responsibility, I like the idea that as consumers, we can believe that what we purchase can empower other people in the world. But how can we have assurance that our decisions, given the interconnections of world economics, can have as big of a difference as we would like, especially when other major countries like China and Russia purchase oil to their own desires?
Linda, thanks a lot for that call. And this is a common argument about things like sanctions or divestment. Great, we stop purchasing it. Someone else will just take advantage of these slightly lower prices, and we've made no difference, Leif.
Yeah, it's a very common argument. If you look at the history of these kinds of movements, this great worry comes up all the time. Actually, in the 18th century, when the British were first contemplating banning the slave trade, the objection was, look, if we don't sell slaves, then the French and the Spanish will sell slaves, and they'll get rich, and we'll be slaves to them. So it's very important for the U.S. to lead the West to get off authoritarian oil. That will do a lot for our own security. If the Chinese and the Indians, say, want to keep importing that oil, well, then they can have the insecurity and the instability around the resource-cursed regions of the world for themselves. The big importing countries, U.S., Europe, China, India, all share this common problem of the instability in the Middle East and Africa. All of us should be working towards moving at once to say, look, we're not going to buy oil from those countries until we can find a minimally decent government that represents the people in place.
Linda, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Leif, your mention of slavery reminds me of an example you give that you say gives some grounds for optimism. I think it was a Manchester cotton mill during the American Civil War. The workers there trying to figure out if they were morally culpable for buying cotton produced in the U.S. and the South, actually, by slaves.
It's so true, and it's such an inspiring story. And, in fact, it's another great Lincoln story. It's such a great one for President's Day. So even after the British had banned their own slave trade and slavery in their empire, they still had to decide whether they were going to buy slave-picked cotton coming from the southern states in America during the Civil War. And there was a big debate in Manchester because Manchester was the center of the cotton trade of the world, and a lot of people's livelihoods, even lives, depended on that cotton getting through. But on the last cold day of 1862, the people of Manchester got together in their free trade hall and held a vote and decided to take no more slave-picked cotton. That was a tough decision from them. Unemployment rose, starvation set in, but then the people of the North in the United States started sending over ships full of provision, and Abraham Lincoln wrote a letter to the people of Manchester thanking them for their generosity and their solidarity. It is a great story, and that kind of solidarity, people coming together and saying, look, we're just not going to buy any more authoritarian oil, any more oil stolen from the people. That's the kind of popular movement that can get us out of the predicament that we're in right now.
Talking to Leif Wenner about his new book, Blood Oil, Tyrant, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. Take another caller now with John in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hello. Yeah, it's interesting. Interesting point of view you've got, especially our supposed ally, the Bush family ally, the Saudi Arabian family, you know, Bandar Bush and all those people who take in their money and support and weaponize ISIL in the Middle East.
John, I got you, John. So Saudi Arabia gets a lot of attention, not surprisingly, in your book, Leif, a long case study, really, of how this all plays out.
It's true, and it's such an interesting story, which is really now only beginning to be understood. The Saudis have been our political allies for decades and decades, but for their own purposes, the Saudi regime has also been engaged in what looks like the largest ideological campaign in the history of the world. They have been sending tens of billions of dollars all over the world to build mosques and study centers and madrasas where this very extreme fundamentalist, anti-Christian, anti-Semitic, and anti-other versions of Islam strain of Islam is taught. And that's what we see mutating into this terrible jihadi extremism all around the world. So when you see jihadi extremism suddenly spring up in Europe, for example, somehow, if you trace it back, you'll very likely find Saudi money behind it, which means that some of that money is ultimately our money coming back to haunt us.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Leif, do you feel in saying we need to change the way we do business with the rest of the world, like a lone voice crying in the wilderness, or do you think we're on the cusp of a serious change?
You know what? When people hear about these ideas, they really want to think about it. We just don't need to buy oil from those guys anymore. They've caused us no end of nightmares, and we don't need their stuff anymore. It might seem like a challenging change, but let me just ask this for the good folks out there. How many impossible political changes have happened in your lifetime? You know, end of the Soviet Union, fall of apartheid, election of an African-American president. It always seems hard. It always seems impossible until the day that it happens.
Leif, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
That was Leif Wenner, Chair of Philosophy and Law at King's College London. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World.
One thing is for certain, there is no stopping them. The ants will soon be here. And I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords.
That's my favorite broadcast professional, Kent Brockman from The Simpsons, incorrectly predicting a space alien ant invasion and helping us mark the birthday of Simpsons creator Matt Groening.
Groening was born on this day in 1954. His creation, The Simpsons, has been on TV since 1989, and The Simpsons family first hit the airwaves back in 1987, actually, on The Tracy Ullman Show.
Most importantly, his birthday is an excuse to play random Simpsons clips.
Step over to the Abdominator, and I will shout slogans at you.
This overcrowding and detention is becoming critical. It's a powder keg waiting to go off in an explosion of unacceptable behavior.
Neighbor, I heard about your heresy, and we've made it our mission to win you back to the flock.
I was a huge Simpsons fan for the first, I don't know, 12, 13 years. It's still going.
Well, I mean, you still quote The Simpsons more or less every day.
And I have people with whom I could communicate exclusively in Simpsons quotes. When we're together, there's always something that triggers, and I don't even know what, there's a huge part of my brain obviously devoted to Simpsons quotes.
Do you have a favorite one?
That's the thing. I can't think of a specific one at any given time. It's always except one of my catchphrases. Only one way to find out is a Simpsons quote. It was the question was, are these garbage trucks amphibious? And Homer says, only one way to find out. And that's become part of my daily usage.
On that note, this is Central Time.